June 20th. Okay. Yes, tomorrow is summer. There is a saying, an old Yiddish saying, which says, who are you talking to? No, I'm doing good. No, I'm doing good. There's an old Jewish Yiddish saying that Ayid is nisht frum. Ayid is erlach. Does anybody know what that means? Ayid is nisht frum, Ayid is erlach. That means the definition of a Jew is not somebody who's religious, it's somebody who has honesty, integrity. Erlich means he has uprightness, right? Of course, that in a way it's difficult because we will discuss this. We have to understand what does that mean. Doesn't a Jew have required to be religious as well? So, for the word religion in general is like it's a word that doesn't sit well with me, at least not as I get older, because when you think of religion, you think this religion, that religion, this, and you have Judaism. So you speak about the three major religions of the world. Certainly there's a sense of truth in that. But Judaism is not religion, because religion implies it's just like a belief in a supernatural being, or even in certain religions, perhaps not a supernatural being, in a certain system, and then laws. But the Torah is more than that. It's supposed to be more than that. But what does it mean if Jews have this saying? And this was a saying because, as I said, the Musar movement started really in Lithuania. So this was a saying in Lithuania, amongst Lithuanian Jewry. Azayid darv zayn erlach. It's fine. No. I'm used to this. It's fine. Tom. It's good. No, it's good. Thank you. So we have to have integrity. So it's what we've been talking about a little bit the last few weeks, but I would like to talk about a different area of integrity now that perhaps we don't often associate with one of the most important parts of being Jewish, and because it goes so much beyond money. Honesty and integrity goes so much beyond money. So I'd like to talk a little bit today about something that is one of the most central values in Judaism, and that is emes. Now, how do you translate emes? Truth, okay? That is the translation. But it means so much more than truth. When we say, let's say, there's a royal signet. Yeah, sometimes it's just a nice picture, but usually when there's a signet, there's a stamp on a seal. It usually represents what the king or the country stands for, right? It represents something that it stands for. So if the Talmud says that Chosamo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Emes, that the seal of the Holy One, blessed be He, is Emes, that it's truth, so that means it must be something very, very important, if that's God's seal. Now, he doesn't send letters and sign it with a stamp. But it means that the way that the Almighty runs His entire world and everything that's in the Torah is a matter of integrity. And also, we have to understand that truth doesn't always mean that it's what you see and what you think it is. MS implies something much more than that. It represents a reality that exists. Out of all the patriarchs, if you look at the stories in the Torah, Yaakov Avinu, the patriarch Jacob, is the one who had to utilize deception more than any of the other patriarchs. Abraham used it a little bit when he came to Pharaoh, when he said, "It's my sister." Yaakov had it with Lavan. He had it with Esav when he took the blessings. His own children deceived him with Joseph. Yet, Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, is the one who is known as the Ish Emes, the man of truth. Right? Even though if you were to look at his life, you would say he's the one who abused if we could say truth more than anyone else. And the reality is that truth doesn't mean being naive. It doesn't mean not seeing things for the way they really are. But it means living one's life consistent inside and outside, externally and internally, and trying to fulfill the goal of why the Almighty put us here. And it's hard sometimes for me to put it even into words, because I don't quite understand it myself 100%, what it means, the emes of Yaakov. The verse in the Navi says, the prophet says, Titen emes li Yaakov. You've given truth to Yaakov. Out of all the patriarchs, Yaakov is the one who's known for truth. He dealt with Esav, who was a cheat, who was a liar. So was Lavan, his uncle Lavan, who was a thief. And he dealt with them when he could in the most civil, kind, best ways possible. But when it was necessary to uproot evil, he himself had to use deceitful means. That is also called emes. Because emes doesn't just mean dealing with truth, it means reality. It means doing what's the right thing to do, to behave in such a way that's straightforward, either in a naive way or in a foolish way, thinking that it doesn't mean when you live around cheaters, you yourself have to cheat. But if it means that if the outcome is going to be disaster or lead to untruthfulness, you have to undo that, and sometimes you have to actually utilize what we would call deceptive means, and then that itself is emes. Now, the difficulty behind that is that it's a slippery slope. Yeah? And you need guidance. I'll tell you something that I love. It's one of my favorite ideas that I learned as a maybe 19 or 20-year-old. When this idea comes from the son-in-law of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. His name was Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Breuer. In the blessings that the patriarch Jacob gave to his children before he died, he gives a blessing to Dan, the son Dan. And he says Dan should be a judge amongst the tribes of Israel. And it says he had a prophecy, and he's referring to Samson, who was one of the great judges amongst the Jewish people who came from the tribe of Dan. And then he says as follows, Yehi Dan nachash alei derech, Dan, his tribe, should be like a snake on the way. A snake. Not exactly your paradigm of what you would think being truthful, simply from the beginning of time, from the beginning of the first story in the Torah. A snake is not something that you would think as being the paradigm of truth. Shefithon alei orach, a viper who goes along the paths. Hanoshech ikvesus, this viper, this snake, bites the heel of the horse, as the horse is running, vayipol rochvo ochar, and the rider falls backwards. That's what he says. I'll explain it partially in a moment. And then he says the words, lishu'ascha kivisi Hashem. In the middle of the blessing, Yaakov Avinu puts in a prayer. For your help, do I anticipate, do I hope, God, I turn to you for help. So two questions. First of all, what kind of blessing is this, right? It's a funny blessing to give a child. Or even if it's a prophecy of what's going to be, what is he talking about? Which you can ask on most of the blessings of Yaakov to his children, because they're all sort of hidden in code. But then the other question I'd like to ask is, why does Yaakov put forth a prayer in the middle of this blessing? He doesn't do it by any of the other children, any of the other sons. He makes a statement, he chastises them, which is also a blessing, so they should know what their faults are. He blesses them, etc. But here, by Dan, when he's speaking to his son Dan, he puts forth this prayer. Right. So the answer that Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Breuer says is a very, very beautiful one. I'm going to give you an example of where I think maybe it'll resonate. When there's a city, the Talmud says it never happened, but in the Torah there's a mitzvah that if there's a city that is all pagan, totally idol worshipping, and they're warned and they don't care, and they diss God, we're talking about in the land of Israel over here, where Hashem's Torah and mitzvahs are supposed to reign supreme, if there's a city that's totally idol-worshipping and they refuse to listen to any admonishment, the city is supposed to be killed out. It's supposed to be totally wiped out. Okay? And the city has to be destroyed and never be rebuilt. Such is the negative effect of idol worship on a place and on its people. When that mitzvah is given, God gives us the mitzvah, and then he says, but God will have mercy on you. It says it twice, he'll have mercy on you. Say the commentaries, why does the Torah tell us that especially by this mitzvah? And the answer is because if you kill, even if your killing is justified, there's a very great danger. And that is that you become a killer. So, if somebody goes to war and kills in self-defense, whatever it may be, and it may be totally justified, it may be necessary, it may be. We don't know all the time, but because we know that sometimes soldiers go on rampages that they shouldn't be going on. But let's assume that they went and they killed and they were supposed to kill and they had to kill self-defense. Even if everything was justified and they did nothing wrong, they still killed. And when you kill, you lose, slowly, you lose a value for human life. I've shared with you numerous times the story of two people, Jews, Orthodox Jews, observant Jews, who came back from Vietnam. And they came to their rabbi and they said, we don't know what to do. We no longer value human life. We saw and did so much killing, like life is not very meaningful to us anymore. And the rabbi gave them advice and he told them to go to children's hospitals, to go to places and see people suffering. When he sees them suffering, maybe they can start feeling again that emotion to be able to feel what it is for a human being to suffer, how much more so to lose life, etc. But it's a very, very great danger, even when it's done justifiably. So therefore, the Torah says, when you fulfill this mitzvah, again, the fact that it never happened, the fact that the Torah is teaching us something over here, the Torah says, if you do this mitzvah, God will have extra mercy on you, meaning He will not allow it, He'll give you a special blessing that He will not allow it to affect you negatively. You need that blessing, because otherwise you're affected negatively. It's the nature of the beast. That's how we are. When we do negative things, we become affected negatively, even if we are supposed to do what we did. When a person deals deceitfully with somebody else, as the verse says, with a deceitful person, you have to deal deceitfully. You can't be an idiot and allow yourself to be crushed and allow the people around you for dishonesty to take place, etc., etc., and the world turned upside down. There's a danger, though, that when you start to deal like that, either if you're victorious, ooh, it feels good, or even if not, you get used to it, it starts to make an impact on your character. Therefore, you have to be very, very sensitive to that. What Jacob told his son Dan, if you've studied the stories of Samson and some of the other judges, when they were fighting the Philistines had a mighty army at the time. They were strong, and they were cruel. And when you're dealing with that, sometimes you can't face the enemy face to face. You have to use deceptive ways, as Samson did. Shimshon, the judge, he was one of the great judges of the Jewish people. He fought the Philistines in a way that he defeated them using all kinds of trickery. And that was necessary. The danger is, though, that it affects him, it affects his tribe. Once you start to use trickery, then it can spread out to other areas of life. So with Yaakov Avinu, what Jacob is telling his son, when the judges go out in Israel and they're going and fighting battles, or whatever it may be, Dan Yadin Amo, Dan shall judge his people. By the way, the word Dan is the same as Din, means judge. The name itself implies judgment. That's the name Dan. Okay? Dan Yadin Amo, he shall judge his people, Ka'ach, like one of the tribes of Israel. Then it says, Dan should be a snake on the way, a serpent on the path, and sometimes you can't fight the enemy face to face. So what he does is he bites the horse in the heel, he sneaks up from the back, and he bites the horse. When he bites the horse collapses and the rider falls off. Of course, it's a metaphor for many, many things, right? Sometimes he's telling Dan that it's okay to do that. If you're a lemelon, you're tzmimistic, you know, and you're always walking ahead with blinders on as to who your enemy is, you're in trouble. But then Yaakov Avinu adds the prayer, and he says, for your hope, I turn God. I turn to, if I for your help, do I turn God? Why? Please don't let this affect the tribe of Dan or anybody else by turning them into deceitful people. When necessary, you have to use deceit, and that is part of honesty. That's part of emes. That's part of emes. Because emes doesn't mean truth in the way that we translate truth. It's just like the Gemara that says, when you see a bride, who, how would we say it? Is homely.
All brides are beautiful.
Right. So you're allowed to say to her husband, what a beautiful bride you have. Even though you don't think that way.
Beautiful in
quotes. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Right? You must have heard my story about the guy who comes to the town and he goes to a wedding and he has never seen such an ugly bride in his wife, in his life. And he can't believe it. So he turns to somebody at the wedding and he says, have you ever seen a more ugly bride? That thing is so meus. I never saw anything like it. So the how dare you say that? That's my daughter. And the guy says, I can't believe it. I should have never done that. I'll never do it again. I apologize. I'm so sorry. I had no idea. I had no idea that you were the bride's father. He says, I'm not. I'm her mother.
Nowadays.
Anyway, the point is that Hillel says, and the halacha follows Hillel, you're allowed to say things. You don't insult somebody. Somebody asks you the truth. Of course, we've discussed this before. So many variations and so many, you know, different. Okay, so that, when we speak about that, on the one hand, the Torah doesn't say tell the truth. The Torah says stay away from falsehood. Stay very, very far away from it. But you have to know the difference between falsehood and dealing with reality. They're two different things. Again, if everybody around you cheats or is dishonest, and the only way you can make a living is by cheating and being dishonest, then go into another business. Then that's not the business for you. People use that sometimes as an excuse. Everybody around me does it. I have to do it also, or else I can't make a living. So deliver newspapers. Whatever it takes. Everybody around you doing it does not make you make it allowed to do it. But if everything is being turned upside down and your very existence is being threatened, as was the story by Esav, trying to take the blessings from Isaac, Lavan trying to take the Jewish people at its root, and turning his grandchildren, who would eventually become the tribes of the Jewish people, into idol worshippers, so then the world is gone. So that took what it took from Yaakov to allow it to be a level playing field. One of the key elements is that the internal and the external match. And let me talk about this a little bit, and then I'll explain a little bit what I mean. The idea of speech, of truthfulness, integrity in speech, but even sometimes in, not only in verbal deception, but even mental deceptions. I'll give you an example that's, Maimonides says, as an example, he takes this from the Talmud. A non-Jew wants to buy a piece of meat from you. He doesn't even care if it's kosher or not, but for some reason he thinks that kosher meat is blessed, whatever, you know, it's wonderful. Or you tell him, this is kosher meat, and you know, kosher meat usually sells at $15 a pound for this cut. You can get it at a different store for $8. I'm going to sell it to you for $6 or for $9. I'm going to give you such a bargain. Because it doesn't make a difference if it's kosher or not. But you know that it's not kosher. You're not allowed to even give him the thought that maybe it's kosher. You're not allowed to give it to him. Even that, really, it makes no difference. And you're not overcharging him. But you're deceiving him. Right? Another example that I like to give. There's somebody you don't want to invite. You don't want to have him over to your house. And you know that meal he's invited. So you go over to him and say, you know what? I can never invite you. I happen to have availability for this meal. Would you like to come for dinner tonight? And he says, oh, I would love to, but I can't. But it's so nice of you. I really owe you one. You know, you invite. That's called Geneva's Das. That's called Geneva, which means theft. It's intellectual theft. I'm not talking about intellectual property here. That's something else. Yeah. That's theft. You're not allowed to do that. What should happen to you is, really? Oh, that's, I was invited out, but I'll try to undo it and see if I can come to you. That would be the right answer to it. So that's called Gnevas Das, and this is a really, really important thing. We give people the wrong impressions. Is it a biblical violation? I don't know, it's questionable. We're not talking over here of, am I technically violating something? We're discussing here becoming the best person you can be. And you can't be the best person you can be if you don't have integrity internally. Even let's say there's no harm done, so to speak. There is harm done. Because the harm is to me. If I don't have internal integrity, then I'm harming myself. Okay? In the Gemara we see the importance of fulfilling verbal commitments, even though it's not... You make a verbal commitment, you fulfill it. It's so important that we actually start off Yom Kippur with Kol Nidre. If I promise that, if I say that I owe you money and I have to give you something, and I promise that I'm going to give you something, or I promise I'm going to do something to you, Kol Nidre doesn't undo that. Or the Hataras Nedarim, the annulment of vows that takes place in Erev Rosh Hashanah, many people do it before Rosh Hashanah. That doesn't mean that I don't have to keep my word. That's used by the anti-Semites against us to say they say something they don't have to keep. That's not what it is at all. You make a commitment to another person, you're required to do it. But you make an internal commitment to yourself. And then you don't keep it. And sometimes it even has, as we know in Halacha, if you do something good three times that you're not required to do, but you do it three times with the intention of continuing to do it, it takes on the power of a vow. But it comes out of Rosh Hashanah, every Yom Kippur, I just can't, it's too difficult, my schedule doesn't work, it doesn't work, I thought I could do it, I could. That's what the Kol Nidre is for. Because if I made a commitment, even if I don't have, by the court system, a legal obligation to fulfill it, I have an internal thing, and if I don't have that integrity, internally I can't go on with Yom Kippur, I can't go on with Rosh Hashanah. So it's amazing that Yom Kippur starts with that. Kol Nidre has nothing to do with the Kol Nidre service or tshuva per se. As a matter of fact, in the 1800s, in my great-grandfather Shul in Regensburg, he was the Rav, apparently he also had a very, very beautiful voice. He had such a battle from the Reform that they tried to outlaw Kol Nidre because they were using it against themselves, against the Jews. They tried to outlaw Kol Nidre. So there was such a battle that my great-grandfather, at one point, he had to give in. The Reform had such strength in Bavaria, in southern Germany, he had to give in. But they worked out a compromise. And the compromise was, let's just say nighttime was 6 o'clock. So he said, services for Yom Kippur start at 6. For those who want to attend, there's a separate Kol Nidre service at 5 o'clock. So it's not part of the Yom Kippur service. That was the compromise that they worked out. It's not part of the service. You want to do it, nobody will show up anyway. They'll come for Yom Kippur service. Apparently, he davened so beautifully, the place was packed. Everybody came at 5 o'clock, and at that time, the Reform gave up the battle. They said Rabbi Meyer won that one. Right? And it was put back into the service. But that's a... But Kol Nidre has been a part of who we are and what we are for a very, very long time. Because the power of speech and the power of the word and of commitment is so important. In the Gemara we see, in the Talmud we see that if somebody doesn't keep his word, he's called Mechusrei Emunah, somebody who lacks trust. In an ideal Jewish world, or in a world where people live trying to fulfill the commitments of being a Jew, if you lack trust, you weren't going to make it in society. Because your word, we know, Jews say the word is who you are. It's like on 47th Street. I don't know if it's still like that today. Maybe it is. But in the Diamond District on 47th Street, when I grew up, not that I dealt with diamonds, but a handshake was a contract and it was your word. And I think along with it, I don't know, maybe you can confirm this, maybe not, but when Jews made a deal with each other, they shook hands and they said, Bracha v'hatzlacha. Mazal would be one way. I heard Bracha, they would say, blessing and success, and that was it. If you backed out of a deal after that, nobody would do business with you anymore. Because that was your word. But when you take me to court, and you say, well, sorry, you didn't sign a contract. Fine, in a court it won't work. but you're mechusrei amona. You're backing out of a deal. If you can't be trusted with your word, that's part of living a life of integrity. It's not easy to do. We all know it's not always easy. People say things, especially in our society, things flippantly. They make commitments. They don't plan on keeping them. When a person makes a commitment, he has to plan on keeping them. It's sort of a curse in the Talmud. The Talmud says that somebody who doesn't keep his word and backs out of a monetary commitment after he made it, even though he doesn't have a legal responsibility and it can't be upheld in court, but the Talmud says the one Misha Para, it's called the one who repaid the generation of the flood, parenthetically for their not caring for others' property, for their lack of integrity, will repay this person who doesn't have a lack of integrity and doesn't keep to his word. Which means, yeah, you'll get away with it with the courts. But, you know, somebody just sent me I'm going to leave that. Okay. The number one question, when you come up after 120 and you stand in judgment, is, did you deal honestly? Did you give and take honestly and faithfully in business? Right. There's an alternative meaning. Nasasav and Nasata be'emuna means that you deal faithfully. It also means you do it with faith in God. If you did it with faith in God, if you really trusted God that He was watching over everything, then you deal one way. Right? If you don't think anybody's watching, you can get away with it. You deal another way. Somebody pointed out to me that it was a short video that went out. There was a Chinese student who was in the United States, and they asked him after 4 years or 2 years, whatever, in business school, if there was one thing he learned. He said that democracy, he didn't understand how democracy can survive ultimately if religion is being pushed aside. Because he said democracy gives so much control and power into the hands of people. And he said if you don't think that you have to answer to a higher calling, people eventually are going to resort to what they can get away with. So this Chinese student, it was just an interesting thing, felt that the more we do away with God, the less chance democracy has of surviving. That was a point of view. Okay, next, we find in Jewish teachings that there are four levels, four different, levels is a poor word, spheres within creation, and they're called domeim, which is Hebrew for inanimate, that would refer to rocks, mountains, etc. Tzomeach, which is plant life. Then you have Chai, which is animal life. And what's the one that's on top of that?
Man.
Mankind, right? So you have, and it's interesting how each one lives off the other one. Okay, so it's called again inanimate, domeim, Tzomeach, growing, plant life, Chai, living animal life. And the fourth one, that in Jewish teaching, the way the fourth level of humanity is described as medaber, the one who speaks. Speech defines our humanity. So to use speech flippantly, or even in our society, we say vulgar speech, belies who you are. Using it dishonestly, to speak lashon hara, are the two, you know, like, the power of speech gives us the power of studying Torah, of praying. The opposite side of that is some of the great worst things we can do is gossip, slander, lying. It also comes from the power of speech, and that defines our humanity. So, the commitment to ourselves, not to what other people think or say, or the way, you know, I'm doing it because the other one is, but because, and this is the idea behind Musar that we're discussing in this series, is that it's not about how can I get away with it, what's the best, you know, like how will it look best to others, what are others going to think, or how can I cut corners and still be within the parameter of being a fine Jew. We're talking about a commitment to oneself, where my external and my internal align with each other. It goes so far as to saying a well-known story from the Talmud that Rav Safra The Gemara says on the verse, there's a verse that we say in davening every morning, that a righteous person is dova emes bovavo, he speaks truth in his heart. The Talmud says, what is an example of somebody who speaks truth in his heart? So the Talmud tells a story of Rav Safra, one of the great sages of the Talmud, somewhere about the 4th or 5th or maybe 6th century, probably not as late as the 6th, but whatever, around that time. And he, for a living, he sold wares, pots and pans. He was a peddler. And one day he's standing by his peddling stand, and a Gentile comes over to him and wants to purchase something from him. Now what happened was, Rabbi Safra realized, I don't know if it was morning or evening, that doesn't say, but the time for reciting the Shema had arrived. So there was nobody at his stand, so he started to recite the Shema. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I don't want to go into the laws of davening, because they're important, but not for now, but when one is saying Shema, one is not allowed to interrupt, and unless you're in between paragraphs, you're not allowed to even make a hand signal. When you're saying the Shema, you focus on the Shema, not on other people. Right? So, somebody comes along and says, I'll pay you $1 for this pot. Rav Safra doesn't respond. I'll pay you $2. And the price keeps on going up. Right? So the fellow thinks he's undercutting it. Like he's asking for too little. So he keeps on going up. I don't know what he went up to. But eventually Rabbi Safra finished Shema. And when he finished his Shema, he turns to this non-Jewish fellow. He says, I'll sell it to you for $1. Why are you selling me for $1? I just offered you 8 or 10 or whatever the number was. Yeah? The answer was that when Rabbi Safra, even though he was saying Shema, he heard the fellow speaking to him. And in his heart, he decided, yeah, I'll take it. That's a price that I'll accept. And he was willing to accept it. And therefore, says the Talmud, that he spoke truth in his heart, and he went back and he sold it for $1. Now I ask you, let's not even take the question, would we do that? Right? Let's not go there. Would it have been anything wrong with Rav Safra taking the price, that the last price that the guy offered? I wouldn't think so. It's not dishonest. It wasn't gouging him. The guy was willing to pay it. He offered it. In our society, we would say there's nothing wrong.
But it's not
Emes. Why? That means it's not Emes to himself. He knows that he agreed to take $1. It's not a question of getting ahead. Can I make another buck? See, in the society that we live, it's all about our getting ahead. In Rav Safra's world, it wasn't about getting ahead. It was about being the best person that I could be. I have to make a living. I got to sell pots and pans. But if he would have sold... So I once heard Rabbi Cardozo said, imagine that 1,500 years later, we're in the year 2019, and we're doing some kind of excavation in Israel, an archaeological dig, and we find a diary written by Rabbi Safra. And he writes in there, on such and such day, imagine that he would have taken the $8 or the $10, whatever, you know. That. And then he writes such and such day, I stole from a non-Jewish customer who came to me. And we would say to ourselves, aha! The Talmud speaks about these people being so great. Here's Rabbi Safra's own diary, and he writes that he stole. Because we know the story now, right? Because in Rav Safra's mind, if Rav Safra is taking $8, even legally, and you might say morally, it says he did the wrong thing, it wasn't MS, and therefore he considers himself a thief. That's why we always say, when it comes to these people, when you think they may have done things wrong, but not in a way that we understand. Right. Why? What's wrong with it? That's being an Erlich Hayid. That's being an honest person, a person of integrity. Because it's not only the commitment to others. High level. We're talking about here the ways of its ways are ways of pleasantness and goodness. When a person, imagine if every time we had a thought to do good, we would really try to fulfill it. We would try to live of our external actions trying to fulfill what we really want to do. Boy, would we do different people. We have good thoughts all the time of things we want to do. And they last
4, 5 seconds.
Sometimes a little bit longer. Right? We don't take it seriously, even if I decided to do it. That's why, by the way, when a person decides to do something good, it's always good to say it to someone else, to tell someone else. Let them call you on it. Or even if not, you have a stronger accountability, even for yourself, when you think that you told somebody else about it. And that's a very important thing. This idea is not an easy idea, but it's the idea that the Muslim movement tried to reinvigorate the Jewish people with. It wasn't a new idea, but as time goes on, and especially, as he said, when you live in societies where they make it so hard for you, and that's not the United States today, the difficulties lie elsewhere, but in many Jewish societies, they made it so hard for the Jews, and still trying to, you know, to keep your inner integrity was a very, very difficult thing. The Talmud describes that when Rabbi Gamliel, in the time of the Mishnah, and here we're talking about maybe the 2nd century, the 3rd century, when Rabbi Gamliel was, he didn't want to allow students into his yeshiva that were not Tocho Kibaro, that their insides were not matched up, aligned with their externalities. The externality has to align with the way I am. Now, how he tested them, I don't know. But they had to align. He wanted perfection. He wanted an elitist yeshiva. When he was deposed of, the Gemara says they opened up the doors, and the Gemara says hundreds and hundreds of benches were added to the yeshiva that day. And the Gemara explains, because Rabbi Yeshua, or others who took over, Elazar ben Azariah, who took over, he felt, no, they don't have to be that. If they keep on studying, and they'll work their way to that. But they're not going to be the only ones who are going to allow in. Okay, that seems to be the attitude of the Jewish people throughout history, because without that, we'd really be aftzaris. Because people are not born like that. Okay, so the externalism has to try to conform to the internal state of mind. By anything that I say today, we're not, even if we're tremendously inspired, we're not going to walk out of here and be those people. But we have to know this is what we have to aspire to. And every once in a while, you're going to say something, and or you're going to do something, and say, wait a second, I made a commitment, or I wanted to be like that. And for that moment, maybe you'll try to have, you know, and we'll work on it, slowly. There's a fascinating Gemara over here. It's in the Gemara in Sukkah. The Gemara discusses the famous verse, mankind, what is good? What does the Almighty seek of you? To do justice and loving kindness and to walk humbly, walk modestly with your God. I know sometimes people leave out that part. They forget that. And they say it's walking humbly, but they forget the part about God. Because if you walk humbly with God, it's different than just walking humbly. There's different interpretations of how to do it. But the Gemara explains over here, what does it mean walking humbly? So the Gemara says a very interesting thing. One of the interpretations that the Gemara says, walking humbly or walking modestly with your God, this refers to the mitzvah of helping bury the dead and helping marry off a bride. Okay? And then the Gemara says, and we can infer from a kal v'chomer, from an inference, if things that are generally done publicly, like burying the dead, it's a public act. Marrying somebody off, it's a public act. Nevertheless, the Torah teaches us, it has to be done modestly and humbly. Things that the usual way of doing it is doing it betzina, is doing it in a model or a private way, how much more so should it be done humbly? So Rashi explains over here, beautiful, Rashi gives two explanations over here. One is that when you go to a party, to a wedding, right, do it, you know, if you're dancing and you're rejoicing, don't become lightheaded. Don't make yourself meshuga. You don't have to become known to everybody who's in the hall. Do it modestly and do it humbly, right? And don't behave with lightheadedness. He doesn't speak about the other part about burying the dead. But then Rashi says, if you have to spend money for burying people, right? A poor person who didn't have money. Or you have to help a bride get married. He should do it humbly. And he shouldn't say, nobody knows that I'm doing this. I got to make it known. Nobody knows what I'm doing. It's a public act. People should know. Do it humbly. How much more so when you do acts that are in private, right? The idea is that we have to try to purify our motives. And that would be the ultimate in Mussar. And the ultimate in Ehrlichkeit is to purify our motives. Our society lives in a position, and I criticize it a lot. I'm part of it. I'm part of what goes on. You know, you try to fight it and whatever. Everything is about people getting to notice you. It's all about externalities. It's always about getting ahead. The Jewish ideal, the Torah ideal of its ways of pleasantness and its paths are paths of peace, getting ahead is a totally different idea than in our society or in the world society. Getting ahead is living with greater integrity and being truthful to your inner self, to match with the outer self when you have a good inner self. That's getting ahead. And there are infinite number of steps between nothing and being perfect. Perfect we're never going to be, right? So the nothing, probably also not, but the infinite number of steps. So it's not about all or nothing, but we have to think about our motives when we're doing things. Am I really a good person? When I do something as a favor for a person, do I do it because I want them to think nicely of me? Do I do it because I want to get ahead? Do I do it because I want to have a business deal with them? Do I do it because I want to impress them? Do I do it because I want other people to think nicely of me? So what's the purpose of doing it? The motive. We have to start working on our motives to walk humbly, to walk modestly, im elokecha, with God. He knows, dayenu. If only he knows, then we're doing very, very well. Also, if you're married, not your spouse doesn't have to know everything, but they should know when you do something for them. That's a good idea. That's a good idea. Right? But this idea of integrity, and again, I remind you what we started off with, it doesn't mean that a Jew doesn't have to follow the mitzvahs, chas v'shalom. But the definition of a good Jew is not a Jew who's frum. It's a Jew who's erlich. Hayid daf nishzayin frum and daf zayin erlich. To have honesty and integrity. And we fight this honesty, integrity, modesty thing in society every minute of every day. It's something as a Jews who are trying to move forward in our ruchnius growth, in our closeness with Hashem, we have to keep that in mind. To try to work on ways. Sometimes you have to do things like we say, somebody gives tzedakah. Right? So sometimes a person has to know their name has to go on a building or their name has to go in a book or whatever. Because I want to inspire other people to do it as well. But internally, a person has to work on that, that it shouldn't be that I'm doing it for the recognition. And sometimes there should be no recognition. You know, person, there's a balance in life. When yes and when no. And it's like that with all things. Right? But, you know, a lot of times with great people, as great as we think they are, you know, everybody knows about it. When they die, you found out, wow, there was so much more that we didn't know. And then you find out, really, that they were doing things in hidden ways. And that's what we should strive for. We should strive for trying to do things in ways the Almighty knows. We're human. We all know we have ulterior motives. But it's something to work on. This integrity, on this truthfulness in our heart, and understanding that emes sometimes means don't hurt another person by saying certain things. That's also emes. The definition of emes is not a simple one. But it's dealing with the reality in a way where you deal with reality, not just you tell it as it is. People say today, you want to know? I'll tell you. I'm being truthful. Be careful when you hear that from people. You know, those are the people you don't want to hang around too much because you don't want to learn from them. Also, you're going to get hurt. Right? Okay. Thank you.